Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:19 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is August 12th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So the Bank of England is talking about taking 100 billion off the size of their balance sheet. And that is on the same day that they have also announced that the UK has had a negative quarter of growth, and that's the first one in a while. And of course, the UK is not the only country that's recorded a negative quarter of growth. Now, quantitative tightening is one of the tools that central banks have. It's an unconventional tool, and they've only really had it available to them for the last 13 or 14 years. We can see that really quite graphically in the Bank of England's total, because it was at zero in 2009, and now it's at 843 billion. So that's rather a lot of money. So when we think about that, the size of the balance sheet has done nothing but rise in the last 13 years, and there have only been very isolated incidences when the size of the balance sheet contracted. Now, if you're the Bank of England and you're faced with a problem like inflation, and you are inhibited from raising interest rates because most of the mortgages in the country are floating rate, and therefore, if the pass-through mechanism for interest rate hikes is much more immediate in the UK economy than it is in other places, well, you're going to be rather constrained from raising rates. So you have other tools available, and the easiest one of those is to reduce the size of the balance sheet. You can affect interest rates without actually moving interest rates, or you can affect bond yields. Now, we should then think about what happens or what has happened in the past when these types of policies have been followed. It gives us a picture of what to expect. Because the one thing that we've clearly had demonstrated to us by quantitative tightening in the past, in both the Eurozone and in the USA, is that it leads to deflationary fears. Now, deflationary fears generally show up first in the corporate sector, because liquidity starts getting siphoned out of the market. They're having more difficulty sourcing liquidity. The interbank market starts to seize up because there's less liquidity available. And then that has a knock-on effect on the repo market, on commercial paper, and on the ability of companies to fund themselves on the overnight basis. So then they start to second guess any plans for capital expenditure, for expansion. You start to see manufacturing starting to really experience pressure that creates the deflationary fears. What we've definitely seen in the past, in both the EU and in the US, is that it doesn't show up as clearly for consumers. And since the aim of the game is to try and ensure the least possible impact on consumers, but still try and get a hold of inflationary pressures, then the reduction in the balance sheet is certainly one of the more preferable things. So let's just then think about what happened to bond yields when the ECB did this, because back between 2012 and 14, they took a trillion out of circulation. So they put in a trillion, they took it out. So that was it peaked in the middle of 2012 and bottomed around the middle of 2014. And what we saw then was initially that from the middle of 2012, the bond yield went sideways and went up a bit, and from the middle of 2013, it went down a lot. Now, let's just think about what happened with the Federal Reserve. They took 750 billion out of circulation between the end of 2017 and the third quarter of 2019. So Let's just look at that chart because we're going to see almost exactly the same thing. The bond yield went up initially and then came down a lot. So let's now just go back and look at what we can anticipate from the gilt yield. So the yield is currently rising. Now they began to take money out of the balance sheet in at the end of the first quarter, and yields went up a lot in the first quarter. Then we've had an additional move recently, and just about every major developed market bond yield rose last week with upside Q reversals on many, and then followed through on the upside in here this week. So this is clear evidence of support in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, we're on the cusp of the Bank of England beginning its quantitative tightening program, and they want to take 100 billion out of circulation. And the Federal Reserve, which anticipates taking 95 billion out of circulation every month beginning in September. So the pace with which the balance sheet is going to contract is going to start accelerating in September. The withdrawals or the maturities have been largely sanitized from the Fed's balance sheet over the course of the last few months, so they haven't really shown up to any great extent in the data because there is some reinvestment of dividends going on, and then there's less money being taken down from the federal government. But that's going to change in September. So we're definitely going to start seeing liquidity being siphoned out of the market before long. Now let's just remember what the quantitative tightening program does. It takes money off the Fed's balance sheet. So it reduces reserves. And that then has that puts pressure on banks. So it's an additional way of controlling inflation. We've seen in the initial stages of the quantitative tightening process that yields rise, and they rise because the central bank isn't buying as many. So then you lose a major buyer from the market, and the yield goes up. But then deflation starts to take over, and investors step in and start buying those bonds because they want to hedge their deflation risk. And bonds become super attractive investments when there's clear evidence of deflation, in just the same way that they're terrible investments when there is a risk of inflation. So then you start to see yields contracting and then doing so in a really accelerated manner. That's what we've seen in the past with both the ECB quantitative tightening and the Federal Reserve quantitative tightening. So then investors are obviously going to ask the big question: is this time different? Is this time different because we have outsized inflation right now? So will the quantitative tightening program, will it simply normalize inflation expectations, or are we going to have a true deflationary event? And of course, this is the big question. I had a question from a long-time subscriber today: are we in a bull or a bear market? I was tempted to just answer yes, but I think that's too trivial. We're seeing a short-term rebound in stocks, but we're still in a medium-term bearish environment. And then the big question is, are we still in a secular bull market? So what are the things that characterize a secular bull market? Well, the first is that buying the dip works. So as long as buying the dip continues to work, we're still in a secular bull market. This is especially important right now. So there's the potential that yields are going to rise in the short term and subsequently fall a lot. And that would be the potential from quantitative tightening. Now, when we look at log scale charts, of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ? Well, let's put on the 60-week moving average, so a 5-year moving average, which is pretty much analogous to the 1,000-day. And if we and I do favor exponential moving averages, so I'm going to put one of those on instead. And we're just going to continue using this chart then for the rest of this broadcast. So the S&P 500 has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it's done that on successive occasions during this secular bull market. And the 1,000-day moving average is a really compelling long-term trend mean. So in the big bull market, up from the lows in 1980, but even going up from the initial low in 1978, the market has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, then accelerated and failed in 2001. So now we've had a wobble in 2020. We've had a significant drawdown in 2022, and now we've seen a bounce. So investors who are long-term in nature and willing to buy dips into the region of the 1,000-day moving average will have done so over the course of the last 2 weeks. Now, the one thing that has characterized every other test of the trend mean since 2010 has been easy monetary policy. So we have not yet seen that. So that's a clear difference here. And it suggests that we may or we could quite easily get a lot of messing around going on around these levels, somewhere between the peak, which is around 4,800, and the lows, which are around 3,500, 3,600. We could see quite a bit of rangy action going on because we're not yet at the end of the tightening cycle. We can then look at the NASDAQ along the same lines. So it had a deeper pullback, also found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And this is the closest it's come to the 1,000-day moving average in this entire bull market. So I think this is a really important area right now. So let's just look at what the bull case is. The bull case is very much centered on the fact that a lot of the bad news has been priced in. We've already had a big pullback and valuations have improved. So we've also seen that we have this really deep pullback where there was a huge amount of commonality. So large numbers of shares were trading below their respective 200-day moving averages. It got all the way down to about 20%, and over the course of the last 30 years, whenever it gets down to about 20%, well, that's usually when you get a bounce. So we're getting a bounce. And the rate has gone up from around 15% of shares below their 200-day moving average to, or excuse me, above their 200-day moving average to about 36%. So that's a pretty substantial rebound over the course of quite a short period of time, and it has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So that's also a positive development. Now, when we think then about the how broad has this move been? Well, we can look at the advanced decline line. And the advanced decline line has rallied over the course of the last couple of days. So it has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So that's also a meaningful development. It's back above the 200-day moving average, and it has broken the downtrend that's been in evidence since November of last year. So this has been both a deep oversold condition followed by a very broad-based rally. Just about everything has rallied over the course of the last 2 weeks. So that also contributes to investors believing that the low is in. And there is a raging argument going on right now between those who think that the low has not been found yet and those that think that we are heading for blue sky territory. So we looked at the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the Bank of England's balance sheet and what we can anticipate from that, in that yields go up first and come down after. And then let's look at the yield curve spread. So the yield curve spread is far and away the most reliable future indicator of a recession. And the signal can be anything from 6 to 18 months in as a lead indicator. So we had the initial inversion in March, and now we are down to about 41 basis points. So let's just look at what has happened following other inversions. We can go back and look at, for example, it was an initial inversion in 1998, then the market became truly inverted in early 2000, stayed inverted for all of the year, and then really came rocketing higher. So let's just think then and just keep in our mind November of 2000. And let's keep in our mind May of 2007. And I guess we could also start to think then about August of 2019. So we're going to be looking at November of 2000 and somewhere around April, May of 2008. I'm just going to put the S&P 500 up and look at those dates. So these were the times when the market went from an inverted yield curve to a positive yield curve. And if we look at the year 2000, go all the way forward here to October, November. That was the initial breakdown. So we'll just zoom in on that. So we had the initial breakdown in October, November of 2000. That was the time after we had an inverted yield curve and we just moved back up into positive territory. And then we had a really significant sell-off. Now let's just go forward and think about the period in, it was around April, May of 2008. We'd already had a breakdown. We had a throwback rally, and then there was a big downside key reversal. And the market came down again and had a little rebound and encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average, whereas before it was only the 200-day moving average. And then we had the really big decline. In 2019, we had an inversion. The market went up for a while, and then we had the recession in 2020. So now we have an inverted yield curve. We often see that the market goes up first, and it's when the yield curve turns around and moves from negative into positive territory. That is when the bulk of the selling pressure takes place. So we're currently seeing the yield curve spread continuing to contract. It's not pushing higher. This is exactly the point in the cycle where you'd anticipate that prices would go up a bit. And the S&P is in the region of the 200-day moving average and closing above it in here today. The NASDAQ 100 is also in positive territory today and will close above the 200-day moving average. So This is really quite a positive performance we've seen in here today. But then bond yields are continuing to rise. So investors are willing to bet that the rise in bond yields will not be sustained because eventually deflationary forces will take place because the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the Bank of England's balance sheet and other central bank balance sheets will contract, create deflationary forces. Therefore, bond yields will peak, come down in a very meaningful way, support stock prices, and will be able to completely avoid the crash scenario and simply go straight back up. So that is what I would characterize as the best of all possible worlds. That we can completely avoid the worst effects of a recession because what it is really doing is just shaving inflationary forces out of the economy. So, in order for that to happen, it means that unemployment can't go up. And that, of course, is going to be a very much influenced by financial conditions and then also by energy prices. So, energy prices in Europe in particular are really a problem. And this is especially true for both consumers and companies. The Netherlands natural gas price went from 150 to 200 in the space of 2 weeks. And there is still scope for them to push this higher. Now, at present, there are, I think I saw the number yesterday, but there are 54 tankers around the world that qualify as floating as LNG terminals. So TK owns a few of those, and the share price continues to push up out of its base formation. And Accelerate Energy owns a few of those and is actively marketing itself as owning those. So its share price is also firming in here. So what we're definitely seeing is that Europe is trying to pull out all the stops, and Accelerate has a floating platform in LNG platform in Argentina, which it's going to sail up to Denmark by September, or perhaps it's October. But what we're starting to see is the migration of these terminals from around the world towards Europe. Europe is literally having to pay up to migrate any kind of floating LNG terminals that could potentially be used as import facilities because their current import infrastructure is at absolutely full capacity. Now, Europe has already announced sanctions on Russian oil and gas that are going to kick in November. And it does beg the question how they're going to be able to do that when even thrifting isn't going to be able to close the gap in how much gas major economies like Germany need to store. So, obviously, this is a problematic event, and it's putting upward pressure on natural gas just about everywhere. So US natural gas prices were up again yesterday and held the advance in here today. And there's obviously an arbitrage between the USA and Europe. Now, the Freeport terminal had to shut down because of an explosion, but they are racing to get that production back online. Now, Devon Energy has a pipeline that goes directly to that Freeport LNG facility. So, if Freeport LNG starts to produce again, well, then that's going to be positive for companies like Devon. I've seen quite a lot of talk too about Birchcliff Energy in Canada, and the share is bouncing rather emphatically also from the region of the 200-day moving average. But then it's worth thinking about oil prices. So oil was down a bit in here today, and there's a downward bias. Now, it doesn't appear quite as much of a downward bias on the daily chart. When you zoom out a little and look at it on the weekly chart, there's a clear downward bias to trading. So investors are also willing to bet that potentially oil prices have peaked, that they're going to come down, they're going to take out some of the inflationary pressures. Certainly, the decline we've already seen in gasoline prices will have taken some of the pressure off of CPI. And both oil and gasoline are back below their 200-day moving averages. So the big question now is, are we going to have recessions? And in those recessions, will commodity prices come straight back down again? And will that then remove some of the upward pressure on wages? And I think that the UK is offering almost like an accelerated concentration of issues that are going to be faced by the rest of the world before the next year is out. So they're already looking at strike action. You have transport workers, they've been going on strike on and off since June. And I was nearly late for the first day of the chart seminar because I hadn't realized that the tube wasn't going to be working. So that was a fun event. But then let's just think then about the fact that transportation workers are striking, nurses are talking about striking. Before long, you'll have teachers talking about striking, junior doctors talking about striking. So they're labeling it the summer of discontent, but they might be thinking that it could be the winter of discontent as well, because energy prices haven't made the jump yet. They're going to be going up in October. So obviously this is problematic, and these are significant issues. It means that the Bank of England has no choice but to try and achieve deflation by erasing the size of its balance sheet and siphoning liquidity out of the market. Now, just how consumer demand is going to be sustained in that environment, I think, is rather questionable. So, if we try to marry these two things together, bond yields rising then falling, stocks rising into an inverted yield curve and falling afterwards. Well, what that suggests is that we're in for a great deal of volatility. And the VIX index is back below 20. It paused around that level yesterday and is back below it in here today. And then if we just turn around and look at the bond volatility index, it's also now back in the region of the 200-day moving average, but bond yields are starting to rise again. And then, if we didn't have enough of moving parts, the People's Bank of China is talking about removing liquidity. But liquidity is absolutely essential for the property sector. So there's been a collapse in the demand for Chinese property among Chinese people. There's been some speculation that the additional stamp duty demanded of mainland buyers will be removed from Hong Kong property. Now, the Hang Seng has been under quite a lot of pressure, and valuations are attractive. Of course, Investors haven't been willing to go near the market, despite the fact that it's got a forward PE of 6 and yields 3% because of all the uncertainty. If they remove the additional stamp duty, and this has been disavowed very quickly by the authorities, but it was, I think, what we could maybe think of this rumor as is kite flying. They wanted to see how it would be received by investors. So there's certainly an effort underway by mainland China to try and bolster the image of Hong Kong. And that does mean that there could be some additional measures to make it more attractive to investors, both from the mainland and elsewhere. On the mainland, there doesn't seem to be a lot of will to support the property market in speculative activity any longer. And the Communist Party has, it is looking increasingly likely that they have made the judgment that the benefit gained from rising property prices has it's reached its zenith, and that subsequently it's going to be about standard of living and affordability is going to be an easier way to keep people in line. And if that's the case, it means that they're going to try and manage a decline in property prices. Of course, since property represents about 40% of the economy, then it also means a managed decline of the economy and GDP. So the inflated GDP figure for China is going to contract over the next few years if they are unwilling to supply the liquidity needed to support property prices. And then let's think about the Chinese banks. They're heavily exposed to the property sector and have been selling off rather aggressively. Now we have a short-term oversold condition, but they're going to have to sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average to really demonstrate that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. So we might see a bounce in the short term, but banks and property are wedded at the hip, and that you simply cannot have a decline in one without a decline in the other, and vice versa as well, of course, in terms of a recovery. So there's certainly the pressure here on the energy market. So let's then think about oil again. The primary reason why oil prices have been in balance and haven't been surging higher is because of a fall off in demand from China and their COVID zero policies and the fall off in the transportation market. But transportation is starting to recover. So that means more Chinese demand. And if they continue to ease the COVID zero policies, it means that transportation demand will also rise. So then oil prices could, in fact, surprise on the upside. So we're at a rather critical juncture here. If the price can push back above $100, then this will look like a failed downside break. And rising oil prices will accelerate the inflationary pressures and put even greater pressure on respective economies. And of course, it will also help Russia's war effort in Ukraine. And Russia is certainly attempting to use more of its economic weapons in trying to further its aim of creating such uncomfortable conditions in Europe that they will have no choice but to abandon Ukraine. And that doesn't look like a likely scenario when we're looking at a drought and heat in August. But when temperatures are well below zero in the winter, and Europe is looking at the potential for rolling blackouts, then willingness by the public to continue to support Ukraine is going to be not nearly as compelling. So I think that we are still in a more choppy, difficult environment than many are willing to give credence to. And a good part of the reason for that is because the large cap companies have been doing better. So the eight large companies are back up to a market cap of about 10 trillion, and relative to the wider market, then the index has also, or the ratio has also pushed back up to a 21.5% market cap of the entire market. So as long as these exceptionally large companies continue to do better than the wider market, then investors are not going to be particularly pressured. So we're in, I think, a delicate situation. The buy the dip scenario continues to work, and we've had a rebound from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Challenges in terms of tighter monetary policy have not evaporated, and we're going to see further tight action in order to really stamp out inflation. The non-core portions of inflation have certainly improved, but if oil prices pop back up on the upside, then that's going to be a very temporary phenomenon, and we'll have even further interest rate hikes. So I do think we're at a rather interesting point here. If central banks persist in raising interest rates, we're certainly going to have a recession. And the bond market is pricing in that potential. With such a deep, inverted yield curve, we're certainly going to have a recession. And it would be exceptionally unusual for the market to bottom before the recession has started. So obviously, then some people are thinking the other way around and saying, well, the market priced in a recession, it's now bouncing, so the recession's over. And it was one of the shortest lived recessions ever, and perhaps even on par with what we saw in 2020. Now, I do think that because the yield curve spread peaked lower last time, that we can anticipate that we'll have shorter cycles overall, and that instead of thinking about market expansions lasting for 7 and 10 years, we might just think about them lasting 2 or 3 years. The one thing that central banks have learned in this cycle is the dangers of leaving monetary policy too easy for too long. So in just the same way that generals are always fighting the last war, then they're not going to do that in future. They're going to restrict liquidity quicker, and we'll have shorter, sharper cycles. And maybe that's the biggest bull case right now, that we've had a short recession, we're going to have another expansion, and then we'll have another recession. And that's certainly it's a possibility. However, I remain of the view that having a hedge against calamity is really not a bad idea at this point in the cycle. This is the biggest threat to the secular bull market we've seen in the last decade. And we could potentially be looking at the end of the bull market in bonds. Now, a bull market like this that has lasted for 30 years already. Well, sorry, I'm going to restate that. It's 40 years already. Doesn't end with a whimper. And this is clearly inconsistent action. So, if my contention is correct, that first we're going to see yields rise, and then they're going to fall a lot. Well, the big question then is whether they're going to exceed the peak. Could we potentially see a big higher reaction low in bond yields? But not right now. But at some point in 2023, that the yield got down to less than 50 basis points in 2020. And it's logical to think that yields will move higher. But then when they do contract, that perhaps they'll bottom around 150 basis points, or they might bottom around 100 basis points and not at the lows put in 2020. And subsequently, when they rise again, they will exceed the peak at 3.5%. And that's very consistent with the view that we are moving into more of a short cycle phenomenon. So then one of the other big arbiters for risk is going to be the dollar. So the dollar is bouncing now from the 105 area. We've had quite a bit of volatility this week, and it very briefly pushed back below the 105 level and then rebounded in here today. As long as the low from this week holds, this is still a consistent uptrend. And until that changes, then we're going to continue to see money flowing towards Wall Street and pressure being exerted on the gold price. So gold is back here at the $1,800 level and still quite steady, testing the region of the 200-day moving average, and it bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So that's quite positive action. Now the next question is it going to be able to sustain this move, or are we going to have it come back and retest the low? Will we get more two-way action? Well, I think a lot of that is going to depend on just how well the dollar continues to hold the low around 105. If the dollar continues to rise from here because the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates again and then again, and is willing to be more aggressive in attempting to snuff out inflation, then we're going to start to see the gold price have more volatility. If, on the other hand, investors continue to believe that we're going to have a deflationary outcome and that the Fed will be inhibited from continuing to raise rates and will instead have to cut rates, then that will be negative for the dollar, positive for gold, and probably positive for just about all commodities. Now we also have the question about reorientation of spending patterns, and the outlook for copper is important. So we had a deep pullback and very clear type 2 top formation characteristics. Failed upside breaks, longer range, first step below the peak, massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And now we've seen a reversionary move, and prices are in mildly negative territory in here today. You have the mining sector talking about needing to increase supply by 10 times and build hundreds of new mines around the world for all sorts of commodities in order to meet the demand from the automotive sector. Now, one thing about the automotive sector, I thought it was interesting. I mean, I was up in Alaska a couple of weeks ago, and I was chatting with some clients of Nevada Trust Company, and one of the businesses they have is they supply cars to the government in Alaska. It's about 600 vehicles. And the government has chosen to hang on to the vehicles because they don't believe that they can get new ones. So these would be sedans. Now, when we look at what kinds of cars companies are building, well, they're minimizing production of sedans. One of the reasons why the automotive companies were building smaller, cheaper cars was to ensure they were complying with environmental standards. So producing a large number of more fuel efficient cars was helping them comply. But now that they're producing more electric vehicles, well, they don't have to build quite as many smaller fuel efficient cars in order to comply with regulations. They get to make a higher margin on those electric vehicles, and then they can concentrate on building trucks, where they get much bigger, and SUVs, where they get much bigger margins. So the change to producing EVs means that they may, in fact, make more money. And Ford is rebounding really quite emphatically. General Motors had also pulled back in a really quite violent manner, but is also now rallying. And then Tesla is going to have a lot more competition in selling electric vehicles, but the share is steadying here in the region of the 200-day moving average. So what this also, of course, means is that there's going to be a shortage of cheap cars around, and that is going to have a negative effect on sentiment. We've often seen that it's inability of people to afford what they consider to be the necessities of life are the things that contribute to a lot of social unrest. And an ability to afford a car is, I think, one of them. So it's not like everybody needs to own a car, and particularly if you live in a big city with lots of public transport. But the reality is that, particularly in the USA and in rural areas, you have to have a car. And this is going to create an even bigger town and country divide. So what it also means, there will be demand for copper from the automotive sector. At the other end of the scale is Chinese demand. There has been a lot of discussion about China and its ambitions to take over Taiwan, and the proclivities of the Communist Party. But I think the number one priority for China is social stability. And things would have to deteriorate in a significant way domestically before they would take the risk of damaging the economy to an extent that Russia did when they invaded Ukraine. So I think that it's not quite as likely that China is going to invade Taiwan because of the knock-on repercussions that it would have for their economy. They are a massive exporter, and they're heavily reliant on imports of all manner of commodities. And sanctions on China would have a disastrous effect on their economy. And especially for a big global trading country, they need to trade in order to prosper. And starting wars with people isn't going to further that ambition. We're just not there yet. Doesn't mean that it can't happen in the future, but I think it's unlikely in the short term given the domestic challenges that China has. What it potentially suggests is that copper prices can stay down for longer because the growing demand in one portion of the global market will be offset by falling demand in China as infrastructure growth slows down. And again, that's also a very benign scenario overall. So I think these are important characteristics to the wider environment. We're at a decision point in lots of different markets. And so far, at least, Wall Street is rallying, stock markets are rallying, but we're still in a tightening environment, and we cannot simply ignore the potential that we could have a negative outcome and that a soft landing will potentially not be achieved. So that's why I've bought out of the money put options. It's basically a hedge against a negative suite of outcomes occurring. And we're also in an environment where it's normal to anticipate a rebound because we still have an inverted yield curve. And investors are willing to, and this, unfortunately, this is not new. This is exactly the time where investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the central bank because they're doing what's necessary to control inflation. It's when the lagged effect of all the tightening hits the economy that you start to see growth surprising on the downside and unemployment rising. And it's the unemployment rate is going to be the big arbiter of what happens in terms of the Federal Reserve's policy. So we're still at 3.5%, and that is similar to where we were in 2019. I don't see any reason that they can't continue to tighten when their two mandates are simple. Their mandate is to control prices, or to create price stability and ensure maximum employment. Well, at an unemployment rate of 3.5%, we are close to maximum employment. We don't have price stability. And that suggests to me that the tightening process is quite a long way from finished. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.